Welcome to Eye to Eye, the podcast of the Royal College of Ophthalmologists. My name is Sunil Mamtora, and I will be your host.
I'm now joined by Helen Devonport, a consultant ophthalmologist who works at the Bradford Royal Infirmary. Helen, thank you very much for speaking with me today about, you know, your personal experiences of how COVID-19 has affected your medical retina service. Just to start with, I was wondering, could you maybe give us an overview of how COVID-19 has affected your service, you know, from the beginning?
Yeah, thanks very much for inviting me to speak. Certainly we've had a dramatic reduction in footfall through the ophthalmology department as a whole. But looking specifically at our retina service and our macular clinic, we've had significant drop in patients attending for face-to-face appointments. Really, the direction came from above. So from our trust headquarters, the directive was that we should only really be seeing face-to-face those patients who were at significant risk of life-changing visual loss. So as you can imagine, that had a significant effect on the number of patients that were coming to see us in clinic, even for the AMD patients. So we started by, we would look at all the clinics that we have booked for that week, and we would go through and triage based on each individual case, really. So it's very time consuming, but that was done by whichever doctor and optometrist were due to be running that clinic and assessing patients in that clinic. Then they would go through and do all the triaging. So we'd then triage, decide who could have a telephone consultation and who would need a face-to-face consultation. Just reiterating again that face-to-face was really for patients who we felt could have life-changing visual loss. And so I can talk a little bit later about how we determined which of those patients fell into that category and how we differentiated the patients. But just to give you an idea of how our numbers decreased during this period over the last 2 to 3 months, if we looked at some figures on Medisoft, so we use Medisoft EMR, and I looked at the overall number of injections that we've done in our macular service. So our macular service covering AMD, vein occlusions, diabetic macular edema, and the other sort of less common things that we manage there. So looking from the 1st of March through to the 22nd of May, back in 2019, we did 590 injections over that period, compared with 355 for this same period this year. So that's a 40% reduction in the number of injections. And I thought, I was actually surprised because it felt like we were doing fewer. So when I looked specifically at the month of April, there was a marked difference there. Looking just at April, we dropped from 223 injections performed in April 2019 down to just 73 injections this year. So 67% reduction for the month of April. So quite dramatic drop in numbers of patients attending. We still have the same number of appointments, but as I've said already, everybody who didn't attend face-to-face would get a telephone consultation, which I think was very important, really, for two reasons. One, to assess whether patients were having any significant visual deterioration. Perhaps even more importantly, in the early days, to reassure patients that we're here if they did notice anything, what to look out for, to know that, you know, that we haven't abandoned them, their appointments haven't been cancelled indefinitely. So you know, patients having some sort of contact with us in the department on the day that they were due to have their clinic visit, I think was really reassuring for the patients. So that was, say, looking at the numbers.
Sure. I mean, that's actually a very significant reduction in the number of patients you're bringing in for injections. You know, how did you decide which patients require injections and, you know, perhaps which patients could wait?
Well, we basically, you know, we were very pragmatic. And again, as mentioning what I said already, this term life-changing vision loss. So if we felt, and obviously that's different for different people, so I can go into that in a little bit more detail in a moment. But if we felt that by not attending, not seeing that patient face-to-face for an injection, we were putting that patient at risk of vision loss that would potentially change their life, then that patient would be invited to attend for injection. So if I give you some examples, it's probably easier to sort of comprehend. We prioritised AMD over D DMO and vein occlusions, because we do know that we can leave patients with DMO and with cystoid macular edema secondary to vein occlusions longer than we can AMD patients without them coming to significant harm. So patients may be experiencing a drop in vision due to their DMO or their vein occlusion over time. However, we know that when we do those injections, we get that vision back and they're less likely to have any permanent visual loss as a result of delaying their appointment. So we prioritised AMD over the other conditions. We then prioritised further only eyes, patients with bilateral disease, so they may have, you know, reasonable vision in both eyes, but they've got disease in both eyes, and therefore they're at a higher risk of somebody, for example, who has a 6/6 vision in one eye, but has got 6/36 vision in the eye that we're treating. So I suppose those are the main things that we looked at, prioritising patients. But every patient was looked at on an individual basis. We're fortunate that we have a Medisoft electronic medical record here in Bradford. So it was actually fairly easy to, when we were triaging our patients, to look at their latest medical record, look what their visual acuities are, look what their lifestyle is. So are they a driver? You know, so life-changing visual loss for somebody who is a driver and is different to somebody who perhaps isn't a driver, who perhaps has poor mobility, is in a nursing home. The level of vision that they need to maintain their quality of life as it is different for different people. So we did very much look at each case individually, but those are the sort of broad things that we looked at.
I mean, those sound like, you know, extremely sensible and pragmatic guiding principles. You know, with regards to what you said about using an electronic medical record, I can only agree with you completely. Mm. Having spoken to, you know, some other friends who work at different trusts and who don't use electronic medical records as much, you know, they really struggled with triaging and identifying which patients could and couldn't be deferred safely.
Yeah.
You know, those guiding principles that you mentioned, you know, they sound really sensible and really pragmatic, but did you ever have any difficulties with having conversations with patients? You know, you maybe felt that they should definitely come in because of, you know, for example, if they had an only eye which was deteriorating.
Yeah.
But they were really concerned about the risk of them coming to harm due to their risk of coronavirus and their other comorbidities. How did you have that conversation with them?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I personally had several conversations with patients who were frightened, really, to come in. You know, they've had the advice from the government about self-isolating because of their age and their comorbidities and you know, were very keen to adhere to the advice that was given. And you can understand that. But I think having a clinician, having a telephone consultation with the patient and discussing the reasons why we felt they should come in and the risk to their vision, and trying to put them at ease about how things had changed in clinic was very important too, because obviously the patients have been used to coming to a really busy, hectic clinic, a waiting room full of people, you know, occasionally there's standing room only. And that's kind of what they still envisaged when you invite them in for an injection. It was really important for us to explain all the measures that we've taken to reduce the contact between patients, contact between members of staff and patients, and make their journey through the clinic much, much quicker than it ever has been before. And so it was important to try and reassure patients about that. Also to reassure them about all the PPE that was being used, that we were, that when examining them, if we needed to examine them, we would be wearing masks, aprons, gloves. The person doing their injection would be wearing the same things. We would offer the patients a mask to wear when they attended. We were adhering to social distancing, and of course, most importantly, the number of patients coming in through the clinics is significantly reduced, so that at any one time there will probably be no more than 3 or 4 patients between our two fairly large waiting areas, allowing sort of way over the 2 meters required for social distancing. So trying to reassure patients was really important. And a lot of patients, once we'd spoken to them, reassured them about the measures that we were taking to protect them and our staff. They were then happy to come in. But one of the other issues we had with regard to patients coming in was that it was the transport issue. So there was a period of time where there was no hospital transport available. They weren't running apart from for emergencies. And so we would struggle to actually get the patients in. If they had no relatives that were able to bring them, they understandably weren't wanting to use taxis. And there was a point at which we couldn't get taxis either. There were no taxis running. So it was difficult to get patients, some patients who were keen to and wanted to come in, actually in because of transport issues.
That's so challenging because, you know, in reality, a lot of the patients who come on transport are some of our most vulnerable patients who need our care the most.
Exactly. Yeah. I would completely agree with that. We at one point when we could actually get hold of taxis, we were offering to bring patients in taxis ourselves to the clinic appointments. Funded through the through our charitable donations to our macular unit.
I mean, those all sound like really pragmatic points, and I suppose at the end of the day, the guiding principle has to be that, you know, if we've given the patient all the information we can, if they're then able to make an informed decision about whether they feel safe to come in for their treatment or their injection, you know, knowing full well the risks and the benefits, and I think we've done our job.
Yes, absolutely.
Did you ever consider, you know, switching therapies, you know, perhaps to, you know, longer lasting medications, or maybe, for example, if a patient's got DMO or RVO, if you felt that, you know, you really did need to treat them, did you ever consider switching them, for example, from an anti-VEGF to an intravitreal steroid implant, which might last longer and, you know, reduce the number of visits they may need to have to come to hospital?
Yes, that is something that we have considered, and as I said, our approach has been very much to individualise this. So we would look at that individual patient's record. We'd look at, you know, have they had a steroid injection in the past? Of course, we're now, of course, not talking about our AMD patients. We're talking about DMO, so pseudophakic DMO patients or RVO patients. As I said, alluded to earlier, we were prioritising those patients. They were sort of lower down the prioritisation list, if you like, than our AMD patients. But obviously, as time has gone on and they've had a couple of telephone consultations in between from sort of start of lockdown to more recently, if we have had those patients phoning in saying that they are having problems with vision, particularly if they have bilateral disease, or they're younger patients, they're working, they're drivers, etc., then yeah, there's a reason to bring those patients in, because, you know, their visual loss then becomes life-changing to them. So we would consider giving steroids in patients where there's no contraindication, so thinking of an Ozudex implant. We would look back, I think, and see whether patients have had a steroid injection before, what their response to that has been. So if we were bringing, a diabetic patient in, and they'd had an Ozudex in the past and actually it didn't do very much, then probably we would still consider continuing with anti-VEGF. In a case where, yes, they've had a reasonably good response, then, yeah, it would make sense to do that, to repeat that and give the patient another Ozudex. Same thing regarding the vein occlusion patients, because we know it lasts longer than anti-VEGF, so the patient's not going to have to attend for as many visits as they would do with anti-VEGF injections. The other concern, though, there, of course, is whether or not there's any associated IOP rise. That's something that I've probably had more patients in my uveitis group, actually, that I've perhaps given Ozudex to kind of tide them over this period, rather than seeing them more frequently and knowing that there's something in there that's working. And in those patients, then I have given them a glaucoma drop or IOP lowering medication to begin at 4 weeks, regardless of whether they've had raised IOPs in the past, so that we don't necessarily need to see these patients face to face to check an intraocular pressure, but feel that at least if they did have a pressure rise, we would be in some way mitigating the risks of that. And so we would give the patient a prescription, give them the Ozudex, give them a prescription for an IOP lowering med to start 4 weeks down the line. We know most patients who get an IOP rise don't get anything in the first month related to their steroid implant. And so we would then just give the patient a telephone consultation 4 weeks after the implant, check everything was okay, and remind them to start taking their eye drop. And then we'd review them telephone consultation again, find out what's happening with their vision a further 4 weeks down the line, so reducing their visits to clinic.
I mean, that sounds like a really good safety net, you know, a way of mitigating any potential problems, because that's probably what we would have done anyway in the clinic if they did have a pressure rise.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's quite low cost and the patient's going to have the safety of not needing to come to the hospital as well.
Yeah, you know, there is always that risk of them having some reaction to the drop. You know, we are potentially over-treating, but it's in the current situation, I think it's probably better to do that than have patients with high IOPs that we don't know about and we're not managing appropriately.
It seems like the most pragmatic thing. You know, one other thing I thought of while you were talking there was, you know, did you ever feel that it could be appropriate to give a patient a steroid implant if they were phakic?
You know, we have some patients where we have considered that. What we would tend to have done in the past, I suppose, non-COVID times, those patients, we would probably combine an Ozudex implant with cataract surgery if they had any degree of cataract at all. Whereas cataract surgery, of course, is currently out of the question. It is an option to go ahead and give a phakic patient an Ozudex implant if it's going to be of benefit to their vision and to their general health. Then it's something certainly worth discussing with the patient.
I suppose it comes down to what you said before, that, you know, every patient's individual and everyone's got their own different circumstances.
Absolutely, yeah. But I wouldn't rule it out in a phakic patient given the current circumstances.
Yeah. I mean, you know, we're all doing our best to ensure that we can give as many injections as possible to the patients we need it, you know, but we're not giving the same number of injections by anywhere near as close as we did this same time last year. You know, do you think that in the long term, patients will have permanent visual loss?
There's always that worry there, isn't there? That, you know, there's when we're seeing fewer patients and doing fewer injections, there is that worry that we may be harming some patients. But I would like to think that we are, to a great extent, mitigating that risk by careful selection of patients, by regular contact telephone consultations with the patients if we're not bringing them in. You know, if I could just give you an example of a patient who may have been attending for an injection in normal, non-COVID times. Let's say, again, we've got this elderly patient with AMD, wet AMD in one eye. They're having regular injections. They've been having injections for some time. They've got some degree of fibrotic scarring. Their vision is maybe 636, 660. Their other eye is 6.6, maybe with a few drusen, but no wet AMD. And that patient, we would previously, had they then developed some fluid on review, we would have injected them. And it may not make any difference to the vision. And I think the COVID crisis, I think, has focused our minds more on what are we actually doing for the patient? Are we treating the patient or are we treating an OCT? So I believe that perhaps we have been over-treating some of our patients, particularly as our clinics can be very protocol-driven with a consultant leading the clinic, but maybe a lot of other allied healthcare professionals, many of whom would be following protocols. And we're not always, I think, and particularly as well in hospitals where there's a large number of virtual clinics going on. So you're not there speaking to the patient. You're not getting that same sort of feedback from the patient. Have they had enough of these injections? So I think sometimes we may be over-treating our patients. And we maybe need to think of the whole person and treat the person rather than treat the OCT scan. I'm sure this is a minority of cases, but it's just something to think about. And I think the whole COVID crisis has kind of focused my mind on really, you know, look at what we're doing for the patient. Is it really benefiting them overall to continue with treatment? And in some cases, I would suggest that may not be the case.
I mean, One thing I've just realised is that throughout our conversation, you've made multiple references to virtual consultations, telephoning patients, and you've mentioned, you know, that optometrists and doctors are making lots of phone calls to patients. How have you found that workload in terms of calling patients, the time taken to do that? You know, have you had any trainees taken away from you, and has your department been able to keep up with that demand?
Yeah, well, we've found that actually we probably overall with the telephone consultations are having to do more individual consultations than we would have done had we been seeing patients face to face. So, for example, if we have done a telephone consultation on a patient early on in the COVID crisis and they weren't having any problems, but knowing they were probably about, they were at that time, they were due to attend for a review or a treatment, then they would probably have a telephone consultation sooner than they would have had a face-to-face consultation in non-COVID times. So the demand has been huge, and we lost our trainees to the wards for just over 2 weeks. Fortunately, we do have them back now, which is great, and they're very welcome back. And they, of course, are helping with our telephone consultations. But what we've also did was we actually triaged, if you like, our telephone consultations. So when we went through the patient's medical records to decide whether they were suitable for a telephone consultation, whether they needed face-to-face injection only or face-to-face with a vision and OCT, which we were trying to keep to a minimum, then we would, the telephone consultations themselves, we would triage into a telephone consultation that could be done by anyone, and I'll explain that again in a moment, or a telephone consultation that needed to be done by a clinician, so in other words, a doctor or an optometrist, one of the people who would normally be reviewing the patients in the usual face-to-face clinics, or whether that telephone consultation needed to be done by a doctor. So we had three levels of telephone consultation. Previously, our nursing staff, who would have been doing the hundreds of injections, were able to help us with the telephone consultations. So a telephone consultation that was marked for anyone to do could be done by one of our nursing staff, one of our optometrists, or myself, or one of our juniors. Whereas, say, those by clinician would be doctor or optom, and then there'd be those that were more complex patients that we needed to have more of a discussion about options would be done by the doctor. So using our nursing staff, instead of them doing injections and moving to help us with the telephone consultations, has actually had a big impact on our ability to manage to keep up with the number of telephone consultations that have been required.
Okay, that's really interesting. It sounds like a lot of planning went into your decision making.
It does, but I think it's worth it. And I think all of this planning is to try and mitigate the risks that we know are potentially there from not seeing our patients face to face. Just a note that if our nursing staff, the nursing staff who would normally do the injections but wouldn't normally have been assessing patients, if they, in a telephone consultation with a patient, identify that the patient was having problems, was worried or concerned, then they would note that, and then either an optometrist or a doctor would call that patient back. But the majority of patients who we'd selected for them to call were not having any problems, and so that was, you know, one less telephone consultation for the doctors and optoms to do.
Sure. So, you know, we're almost approaching the end of May now, and the government is starting to relax some of the lockdown measures. You know, with this, possibly things are going to start to move towards being normal, although maybe they may never go back to being what they were before. You know, what are your plans for increasing your service and starting to go back towards that new normal?
You're absolutely right. It's going to have to be a new normal. We're not going to be able to go back to the numbers of patients that we had coming through the clinics until we have a vaccine. And of course, none of us know when that's likely to be. I think we've learned a lot. We've had to make a lot of changes. I think we've learned a lot about how we can do things differently. And we're going to be employing some of those tactics that we've started to use during this period, I think, even once lockdown is completely over, in order to try and make the clinics more efficient, mean that patients spend less time in the department, And there's sort of just a better flow in the clinic, so that during the, for the period that we need to maintain social distancing for our patients, then we can do that. So we will continue doing telephone consultations for some of our patients. Again, requires that detailed triaging, but I think that's worth it. It's time well spent. I think we will also perhaps not be doing as many visual acuity checks and OCTs. So, for example, if we have identified in an AMD patient that through treat and extend, that patient's ideal interval between injections is 8, 9, 10 weeks, whatever it may be, then we would just bring that patient back for an injection three times at that interval before then trying to extend that. Which means that, you know, the patients are spending less time in the department having visual acuities and OCTs. So far we've been very much focusing on our follow-up patients and haven't really spoken about new referrals to our macular service. I think something we'd like to do is to work much more closely with referring optometrists with regard to imaging, and those optometrists that do have an OCT, it would be ideal if we can get an opportunity to be able to review the OCT that's done in the optometry practice in order to triage, if you like, our referrals before they even get to us, and give review OCTs, give advice to optometrists, and maybe then arrange routine appointments for patients who have dry AMD or have, for example, a pigment epithelial detachment on an OCT but no sign of any fluid or hemorrhage. So I think we would require closer cooperation with our referring optometrists to help to reduce the number of false positive patients that we have coming in, because we are quite a significant proportion of new patient referrals from optometrists in the past were actually other things. You know, there were macular holes, epiretinal membranes with macular pucker, and various other things. So I think it would be really useful for us to be able to share images with referring optometrists.
Well, Helen, that's been really interesting, and I've learned a lot from our conversation, and hopefully, you know, other listeners might be able to take back some of those points to their own departments too. So thank you very much for joining me today.
You're very welcome. It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
As always, we'd love to hear from you. If you want to get involved, talk about your work, or have any feedback, send us a message at communications@rcops.ac.uk.